tonight's Sunday night experience, the big book, and this is our last episode that we're going to do step four. We spent quite a bit of time on step four. I hope it was good. We looked at all the instructions in the big book on resentment, fear, sex. We're looking now at the steps we took. We looked at the second step proposition on fear, and it's helped me a lot. I don't know if it's helped anybody here, but it's helped me a lot, and all the instructions are in the episodes. Tonight we're going to finish up with the steps we took on step four by Joe McHugh, and he was the impetus behind the Joe and Charlie starting the big book in 1980, and they did 35 meetings a year for 20 years, and they kept the message going about the big book and how the big book comes alive. And I didn't understand the big book till I listened to them. And when Curtis died, I thought I'd do a meeting here that we could do similar to Joe and Charlie, so that we could see the directions and see this as a textbook, and so at least we would know what we need to do. Now, whether you do it or not, that's up to you. So we're on page 59, and it says, we're going to do number one for selfish, self-centered person is resentments. We've talked about that a lot. This is anger. It could be anger in the past that you're reliving, or it could be anger that you have today towards someone. It blocks me from God. You can't have anger and love in your heart at the same time. And at the time we have resentments, these thoughts dominate my mind. And so what he says is, I'm turning my life over to the people and things I resent. And I use the example of sitting at home, stewing about somebody, planning their execution about something that happened that day, and they're watching Big Bang, and they don't even know you're alive. Now, how's that working for me? It's so silly, but we do it. We led our whole lives like that. And we still carry around a lot of these resentments we had when we came in, and that's what we're looking at in the fourth step. And we're looking at the story of my life, self-centered, in which I was constantly being threatened by self-will, and I was angry all the time. And it says, if people and things we resent are directing my life, I can't carry out the decision that I made in step three. Same is true for fear and harms done to others. When I have fear dominates my mind. I don't know if any of you have had fear, but when you have it, it's there. And we've learned tools in step four to be rid of fear. And when I've harmed others and I've committed bad acts, I have guilt and remorse, unless I'm a psychopath. No, sociopath, excuse me. You could be a psychopath and have feelings. There are three major areas of your lives we look at this. So we're looking at the areas of our lives when we run a life on self-will in which we're disturbed. And he says in the next paragraph, I'm either mad about something or afraid of something or someone, or I've done something to feel ashamed or remorseful. And we live our lives this way. Anybody do this before you came in? And you can still do it. You could be sober. So not drinking doesn't treat this. And we start out with the resentments. We analyze them and we see where they originated and we talk about them. And so we're willing to let go. And we're actually looking at the analyzing the information. We're going to use this the rest of our lives in steps six and seven. We're going to look at why I have anger, why I have fear, why I take wrong actions. In the next paragraph, he talks about, if I have self-will, I make wrong judgments, which he calls resentment, and wrong belief, which he calls fear, and wrong actions from harming people. And he calls them wrong. And he says it looks at wrongs in a broader sense. And so we're actually looking at our wrong thinking, and then my thinking leads to my actions, right? And so when I harm others, it's because my thinking was wrong. I usually act out of fear, act out of anger. And he calls wrong judgments, here's this chart, resentment. So I was thinking, what are right judgments? Right judgments is when I don't get disturbed. Right judgments is when I accept the things as they are. Right judgments is when I don't have to get bothered and I can see the truth about it. Wrong believing is fears. Right believing is to trust God, live in the now. And wrong actions, it's harms done to others. So we're really looking at wrong thinking, which is Michael-centered or self-centered, versus right thinking, which is God-centered. And he says we analyze to the root cause. And then I'm going to skip the next paragraph. He's just talking about venting your resentment doesn't do any good to anybody or yourself. And then he talks in the next paragraph how we write these things down, and we write them down so we take them out of our mind. And then at the last line it says, if I can see the truth about my resentments, I won't have them anymore. Think I believe that's true? If you can see the truth about them, you can see them differently. So what he's saying is that the resentment itself, whatever the act is, it's a slide on the wall. And you're looking at a slide. And what we do is we change the projecting booth. We change the way we're looking at that event. And when we do that, it's called like a new pair of glasses. You see things differently. And I can see how I caused the resentment. I could see how I didn't have to get disturbed. I could see how I was practicing self-centeredness, how I was fearful. And I could see the truth about it, that sometimes people just are who they are. They're human beings, and we're all God's kids. And they may not act the way I like, but then I have to understand that I'm not in charge of the world. And so I can forgive. So there are a lot of ways that you can be free of resentment. If you do the inventory right, you should be free of all the resentment. And if be able to forgive everybody and be willing to make amends if you've harmed them. We've looked at those instructions on page 66, 67 a million times. The next paragraph, he talks about it. We're looking at a crime scene. When you look at a resentment and you're looking at the evidence, and the first thing is the name of the person that you're angry at or you have resentment for. And the first thing we do is we list all the names of the people, institution, or principals. And we put names, and that's the first column that we talk about. And in the back of this sheet is a chart that you can use if you're doing this. Then the second page is, and he talks about how you do one column at a time, because if you start with the name and then you go over to the cause, then you're getting confused. So the way it's written in the book is you list the names first, then you look at the cause. I don't know if you have to do it that way, but it's the way I've done it. It's the way I think it makes sense. And then the second column at the bottom is the cause. What did they do? And the cause is related directly to the name that you put down there. And if you see this chart here on review of resentments, it says, I'm resentful at, column to the cause. The self column, which is column three, is what was threatened. Which part of self caused the fear? So whenever I'm resentful, I have a fear, and it's threatening my ambitions, my sex instinct, my security or social instinct. I didn't know that before I came in here. Now I know if I'm ever angry about it, they're threatening some way myself, my false sense of self, people call it my self-esteem or my pride the way I see the world and what I think I need. And then when we do the inventory according to the book, after the third column, we look at this from a different angle, and we look that the people who harmed us may have been spiritually ill, right, just like us. And then we ask God to give them patience, tolerance, and pity as we would a sick person. We ask how we could be helpful for these people. We ask God to save me from being angry, and we ask for a kindly and tolerant view of everyone. And that should change the way you see this action or this person. If it doesn't, keep doing it. So I do it automatically now when I get bothered by anybody. I just say, God, they're all God's kids. That's just the way they are, back in self. It's one of my instincts is being threatened. And I say, God, save me from being angry. And I just give me a different attitude, change the way I see it. We're all human beings. And I try to do that in 15 seconds because I don't want to waste any more time than that. I mean, it's just been a waste of time in my life. Then on the next page, we'll turn it over. It says, in the next paragraph, they talk about my mistakes, and that's the fourth column. And I can see how I've done something to cause the resentment. If I can't see anything like fear or dishonesty right away, I know I'm always being inconsiderate because I'm judging. And I don't like the way I see them, and I'm being inconsiderate. They are who they are. And I know it's back in self. And I do that to build false sense of self-esteem. It's very sick. I wish I'd stopped doing it. But that's the way we're made. Sandy Beach said he wasn't going to, he wrote down the date and the time, he wasn't going to have judgment at all for the next week. And he had like 80 judgments in 2 days, and he was doing it all times. So he said, well, that didn't work. And so pay different attention. But we know that we're wrong when we're disturbed, right? And then if we look at our columns, they talk about in the second full paragraph, and I don't think this is true, it says we can't change the third column. Only God can overcome self. But I don't believe that, because I believe that only God can overcome self, but I can ask God to help me bring into the situation different characteristics than the self-centered one, like the St. Francis prayer, which we talked about on Wednesday. We went through that. If I bring love, if I bring harmony, if I bring truth, if I bring all these qualities, then I'm not going to be resentful. And if I bring in comforting and understanding and love, I'm not going to get angry. And so if I bring the qualities of God into each situation, I won't get angry. Now, what happens is I may get disturbed, and then I have to remind myself I didn't bring those qualities in, and I have to bring them in now. And so what do we bring is what we get, right? And so that's why I find the St. Francis prayer is so powerful for me. And he says that, so we know now when you're bothered, you're in the third column, you're back in self. And you can't change your self-centeredness, but you can try not to practice it, which is 6 and 7, right? You're going to try to practice a different way. You're going to try to practice the opposite character defects. So you can use that information on a daily basis. And then I'm going to skip the last paragraph. And then he talks about the Soviet Union put up Sputnik, so we decided to go to the moon. So we were going to, and so we had the whole moon program because we weren't going to let the Russians get there first. So we spent $18 trillion and we got somebody on the moon. They hit a golf ball, and I guess we made titanium. And I guess we got something out of it, but you know, really, I'm getting off track here. Now, the first full paragraph on page 65, he talks about we're not really getting rid of things. We're trying to give them power, less power. I don't know if that's true. I want to be free of my resentments, and I think we can do that. We could do that through the prayer. But what he makes the point is we're rearranging things into proper perspective. And on page 27, Carl Jung talks about people have a rearrangement of their way they see things, of their ideas and attitudes. So what we do is we see something and we change the way we see it. Remember, alcoholism is a disease of perception. It's a disease of the way I see things. And so I'm seeing things wrong, and I don't have to see them that way anymore. That's the relief of the bondage of self that I get from doing the steps, is I don't have to be bondage in it. I have the option of changing the way I see it with God's help. And they talk about step 10, when you're looking for this, you're in the world of the spirit. You have a relationship with God. So you're watching with God. And then when you separate with God, you don't even see it. You just stay in the disturbance. And so we have a great gift here if we work this. It's a powerful thing. It says, the work we do on step 4 enables us to begin to know and understand ourselves. We can see the real person that we can be and not the person we create when we're in self-centered. We don't have to be that way. It's a study, a lifetime study of ourselves. We're always looking. We're always uncovering, discovering, discarding these old ideas we have about things. And we're always willing to let go of the way we're seeing things to change. And you'd be surprised how people can look better when you do this, and they're the same. And situations are better, and you get along better with people. And people even begin to like you a little bit because you're not this angry, judging son of a gun all the time. That's not true for anybody in the room, but for me, I could see it now. I could say, gee. I was really silly. And it says, if something says something we don't like, something may hurt our feelings before, it doesn't have to hurt now. We don't have to react negatively. And remember, it says on page 85, if we're in fit spiritual condition, we react differently.
So if I'm fit spiritual condition, then I have a relationship with God. I'm not self-centered. I'm trying to be God-centered. I don't have to react the same way. Does that make sense? And it says insanity is the inability to see the truth. Sanity is the ability to see the truth. And inventory is a tool to enable us to see the truth, and the truth sets us free. We don't have to be in bondage to self. And inventory is how we do it, and step four is the beginning. And the information we get in step four we use for the rest of our lives. So there's two charts in here. There's one on this review of sex conduct. What did I harm? What did I do? Where did it self, and what was my shortcomings? You can do fears this way, or you can do it the second step proposition way. I'm fearful of, why do I have the fear? Why wouldn't I give it to God? What's being threatened, and what's the exact nature of my wrong causing the fear? So, I hope that was helpful. It's kind of a final review. Now, he refers to this handout on self-pity in here. I think it was one of the pages we didn't read tonight. And so at the back of the steps we took in the appendix is, sorry about the rustling of the papers, but I'm getting a microphone, so the future podcast, you won't hear the rustling. It's usually me, by the way. So I read this appendix, and I'm not sure I understand it. So I'm really interested to see what other people think of this. It's talking about self-pity. Now, I looked up self-pity, and self-pity in the definition I saw in the is excessive self-absorbed unhappiness over one's troubles. What do you think? Excessive self-absorbed unhappiness over one's troubles. And then I wrote dash, quote, depression. So when people tell me they're depressed, they have an excessive self-absorbed happiness over their own situation. And you don't treat that with a pill. You treat it with the steps. This kind of depression that alcoholics have. Now, you can have other types of depression, but anybody else get excessively self-absorbed unhappiness over one's troubles? I think we all were that way. We didn't know how we got in this situation, right? This happened to me. I tried so hard. I was a good guy. My motives were good. It's not true. See, we can't see it when we come in here. And so here's what he says. He says, once a self-centered person is offended by another, the self-centered individual then resents his own position in life. So I was trying to figure out, what does that really mean? I guess I placed myself in a position to be harmed with my self-centeredness. Or I made decisions based on self to put me in a position to be harmed. And so I think that's true, and I'm not sure if it's true all the time. But if somebody cuts you off on the highway and you want to execute them, you know, Tom's in the room and he's our driving expert. why do I hate that person? Myself. I guess you hate yourself because you got behind this person or you didn't leave earlier. But in relationships, you could say, you know, how did I get into this situation? It's so horrible. And you could help, you resent that you put yourself in this position. That could be true. This is self-resentment or self-pity. Resentment itself is a major emotional problem. So you could have excessive self-absorbed unhappiness over my trouble, and then you could hate yourself for being in that situation. So you can have both. I think that's what he's trying to say. It is a destructive emotional bad habit. You know, I think self-pity is lethal. And it's hard to get someone out of self-pity when they're in it. I mean, it's almost impossible because for some reason they don't want to get out of it because then they'd have to do something about it, which he's going to talk about. He says, resentment against self is almost always associated with resentments towards others. As soon as the person is offended and reacts with resentment towards others, he automatically directs the same deadly poison towards himself. Now, we talk about resentment is me taking poison hoping you'll die, right? And there is this boomerang effect that when you're angry at someone, it just disturbs me. It just bothers me. And I'm the one that suffers from it. And I don't have God, and then I want to react. And he leads to unhappiness and failure. He says, if you persist in the overuse of self-pity, he sees everyone else as a success and him as a failure. I think that may be true. I haven't been in this type of self-pity in a long time, so I don't I can't remember, but I think it's probably true. Others can talk about it. You see other people that their lives are great and things are going so well for them. Why isn't it happening to me? And this kind of stuff. You constantly resent your position in life. Now, what I got out of that is we says we play the role God assigns and we stay close to him, then we get everything we need. And Sandy Beach does a whole talk on the 10th step, which he talks about there's a play. And in the play, I'm asked to play the butler. And I have this play in which I'm supposed to play the butler. And the real play is everybody seeing how ridiculous it is for somebody as wonderful as me having to be the butler, that I should be the leading man. And so I think what we do is we don't like the role we're assigned, and we resent it. And then we get angry at whoever put us in that role, and then we get angry at ourselves for being in that role. And it's all in our mind. None of it's really true. And he says, as soon as you accept the role you're supposed to be and you do the best you can that role, then you'll be right with God. And to not accept the role God assigns, I have to tell my story that I don't like it, you see? And so we do that all the time, and then I think that leads to self-pity. Here he talks about constructive use of self-pity. I guess, or resentment. There are two houses on the block, and one's crappy, which is mine, and one's beautiful. And he says, instead of getting angry at the person who has the beautiful house, we would paint our house. So that's positive. That's a positive action. And so he's talking about what kind of actions do we take when we're in self-pity? Do we take positive actions to change our situations, or do we just stay in this negative emotions, which paralyzes? And I think alcoholics relate to that. And then he talks about destructive use of self-pity. One needs painting, one doesn't. And he says the guy feels on the porch, says, I don't have money to paint the house. And why doesn't he have money to paint the house? Because of this and this and this. And then how did he get in this situation? And he feels so sorry for himself. And then he hates the person across the street. His life's a mess. And feeling sorry for ourselves, I think that's one of the great joys of being an alcoholic. You know, oh my God, look what happened to me. It's not fair. I tried so hard. Jesus, where'd these people come from? I wrote, feel sorry for himself, his situation, and blames others for it. Did anybody ever do that? Blame others for your situation? Because we can't blame ourselves, remember? And that's how we lived in resentment our whole life. It's a really good picture of what it's like before you do the steps. And you can be this way sober. That's why sobriety won't change anything. It just means you're sober when you deal with this. And if you have emotional sobriety, then you have tools to deal with this. And then you can live happy, joyous, and free. He says self-pity relates to self-centeredness. It's part of the term. The stronger the self-drive, the stronger the self-pity. I think because the more the self-drive, the more you're in conflict with everybody and everything. The more anger and resentment you have, the more harms you do. And he says this, we're constantly in collision with people, places, and things. Remember on page 6062, a life run on self-will can never be successful. And then they describe how we're running the show, and we're just trying to be people pleasers. Are we being people pleasers by trying to be kind when we really just want to get our way? And we're prone to self-pity because it doesn't work out. And then I say, it's not fair. They're not treating me right. How did I get in this situation? Oh, my God. The resentful self-pity person, now I like this, is a total reactor. His happiness and contentment are based how others perform in his play, in the role he assigns, in the script. And what they're really saying is that your dependence on other people, not God, and your dependence for approval on other people. Remember, we all want approval as alcoholics. That's our basic thing. We want to be loved, and we want people to think well of us. And then we're dependent on all these people, and then it doesn't work out. And then we feel inferior, and we have self-loathing, and we have self-pity, and it's not pretty. And the self-pity or self-resentment becomes deep-seated. We see the impossibility of overcoming self-pity. And we can't follow through in the steps, and we can't have a relationship with God if we're in self-pity. So I think the self-pity is the final straw that separates us very deeply from God, puts us really far down there, moves that paperclip away from the magnet. We talked about we're a paperclip and God's the magnet, God's the power. And the closer the paperclip gets to the magnet, the more power I have in my life. And the further the paperclip gets away, the less power I have. And self-pity puts the paperclip in the other room. That's what I think it does. It puts a wall between me and the magnet. And it says, step three, once self-will has been tempered and removed, the overuse of self-pity will disappear. The individual learns to accept his role in life. It is what it is, right? Acceptance is the answer, accepting the role as it is, and changes his pattern with response to the action. So we're going to take positive actions on situations now. And we're going to react differently because we're in fit spiritual condition. At this point, the destructive force of self-pity will become a constructive force used to obtain goals. Thus, we find the recovering person to be a healthy individual who exercises his natural instinct to promote contentment and serenity along with his healthy competitive progress. And I think the non-recovering person is an unhealthy individual who uses his instincts to promote disarray and discontent among everybody, and especially himself. So they talk about monitoring this instinct. Once this instinct has become a major problem in the life of an individual, its intensity should be monitored daily. Each feeling of self-pity should produce action. So every time we feel disturbed, we're bothered, we feel sorry for ourselves, we have to say, you know, how did I get myself in here? What's the truth about this? What can I do? And remember, they talk in the big book, turn your thoughts to others. Turn away from me. Turn how I can help somebody. Self-pity should be dealt with as soon as possible because it only produces pain. And we monitor self-pity. Remember, we monitor selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, fear all day long. And when we're ever in one of those, it's going to lead to self-pity. And we don't want to do that. The emotional bad habit of recalling old incidents of the past to relive self-pity must be eliminated. And maybe that's why some people relive resentments. I just thought of it. It's because they want to get that feeling of self-pity for some way. It makes them feel better because then they can blame everybody else for their situation. And then they can use that as an excuse for why they're not doing something about it. And it says positive responses must be developed. The old I can must replace I can't. And I wrote, what can I, what do they say when it says I can't? I can't let go. I can't forgive. I can't change. I can't see them in another way. When I say that, those ideas in my head, then nothing's going to change. And when I say I can forgive and I can let go of this and ask God and I can change from fear to courage and I can see things another way, then things get different. Does this make sense? I don't know if this was helpful. It's the first time I've gone over this self-pity. You might want to read it with other people, but we can open it up. We have some time now to open it up and talk about this. And next week, we'll start on step 5 with the big book. Okay, guys? Thanks.